This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of pediatric abuse from the pediatric section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Pediatric abuse is the second most common cause of death in children, and 50% of fractures in children younger than 1 year of age are attributable to abuse. Diagnosis can be suspected with a pediatric injury that is inconsistent with the mechanism of injury, a delay in seeking care, long bone fractures in a non-ambulatory child, or the presence of highly specific fractures. Treatment involves reporting abuse to the appropriate agency and hospital admission for multidisciplinary evaluation. Rarely, operative management of fractures may be required. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, as far as incidence, greater than 1 million children are victims of substantiated abuse or neglect in the United States each year. Child abuse is the second most common cause of death in children behind accidental injury. Head injury is the most frequent cause of long-term physical morbidity in the child. As far as demographics, 90% of fractures due to abuse occur in children younger than 5 years of age. 50% of fractures in children younger than 1 year of age are attributable to abuse. 30% of fractures in children younger than 3 years of age are attributable to abuse. The most common cause of femur fractures in the non-ambulatory infant is non-accidental trauma. Social risk factors for pediatric abuse in the child is being first born, an unplanned pregnancy, a premature child, a child with disabilities, for example cerebral palsy, and stepchildren. Social risk factors for parents include a single-parent home, recent social stressors like moving or a job loss, unemployment, drug use, personal history of abuse as a child, lower socioeconomic status, and lack of a support system. As far as types of child abuse, and note that you can have more than one type present, includes neglect, which makes up 78% of child abuse, physical abuse, which makes up 18% of child abuse, sexual abuse, which makes up 9% of child abuse, and psychological abuse, which makes up 8% of child abuse. Moving on to presentation, keep in mind that pediatric abuse involves an injury often inconsistent with history. Red flags include delay in seeking care, no history of injury or an inconsistent story, certain high specificity fractures, moderate specificity fractures, and other injuries concerning for abuse like multiple bruises or burns. High specificity fractures include long bone fractures in a non-ambulatory child, a classic metaphyseal lesion, which is a fracture at the junction of the metaphysis and the physis or the primary spongiosa. This can be secondary to a torsional slash traction shearing strain when the infant's extremity is pulled or twisted violently. Classical metaphyseal lesions have a high specificity for child abuse. An example of a classic metaphyseal lesion is a corner fracture, which is a discrete avulsion of the metaphysis. Another classic metaphyseal lesion is a bucket handle fracture, which is a horizontal avulsion fracture with the appearance of central and peripheral components, which gives the appearance of a bucket handle. Keep in mind that an avulse bone fragment may be seen on face. Other red flags for pediatric abuse include transphyseal separation of the distal humerus, rib fractures, especially posteromedial, scapular fractures, sternal fractures, and spinous process fractures. Moderate specificity fractures include multiple fractures in various stages of healing, vertebral body fractures and subluxations, digital fractures, and complex skull fractures. Again, other injuries concerning for abuse include multiple bruises and/or burns. In terms of symptoms, pediatric abuse patients will likely have pain related to fractures and know that fractures are the second most common lesion in abused children. In terms of frequency of fractures in these patients, the humerus is the most common, then the tibia, and then the femur. Diaphyseal fractures are 4 times more common than metaphyseal fractures. As far as the physical exam, be sure to look out for skin lesions, which is the most common presenting lesion. Moving on to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include an AP and a lateral of the bone or joint of suspicion. Initial evaluation should include a skeletal survey. A bone scan is an alternative or adjunct to the radiographic skeletal survey in selected cases, particularly for children older than 1 year of age. This provides increased sensitivity for detecting rib fractures, subtle shaft fractures, and areas of early periosteal elevation. A bone scan is not useful in metaphyseal or cranial fractures. The differential diagnosis for pediatric abuse includes true accidental injury, osteogenesis imperfecta, osteopenia of prematurity, scurvy, copper deficiency, Menkes disease, disuse osteopenia, that is in non-ambulatory or minimally ambulatory children, and chronic disease, specifically of the kidney and the liver. treatment of pediatric abuse can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management involves reporting abuse to the appropriate agency, hospital admission, and CAST application. With respect to reporting abuse to the appropriate agency, as far as indications, know that physicians are mandated reporters and are legally obligated to report suspected child abuse and neglect. Physicians are granted immunity from civil and criminal liability if they report in good faith, but may be charged with a crime for failure to report. Early involvement of social workers and pediatricians is essential. Hospital admission is indicated for early multidisciplinary evaluation. Be sure to admit infants with fractures to the hospital and consult Child Protective Services, and be sure to obtain a social service consult. In terms of CAST application, remember that most fractures are splinted or casted until adequate callus has formed. Operative intervention is rarely necessary, however, can be definitive treatment as indicated for a particular injury. Finally, let's end this review session talking about prognosis of pediatric abuse. And know that if unreported, there is a 30 to 50% chance of repeat abuse and a 5 to 10% chance of death from abuse. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. First question. An infant child is referred to you for a femur fracture. The mother reports that the child sustained an unwitnessed fall, but the actual circumstances surrounding the fall are unclear. When comparing pediatric femur fractures arising from non-accidental injuries to accidental injuries, which of the following statements is true? And the choices are 1. Distal metaphyseal corner fractures are the most common fracture pattern in non-accidental injuries. Mid-diaphyseal fractures are the most common fracture pattern in accidental injuries. And the child sustaining a non-accidental injury is likely to be older. 2. Mid-diaphyseal fractures are the most common fracture pattern in both groups. The child sustaining non-accidental injury is likely to be younger. 3. Distal metaphyseal corner fractures are the most common fracture pattern in non-accidental injury. Mid-diaphyseal fractures are the most common fracture pattern in accidental injury. There is no age difference between groups. 4. Mid-diaphyseal fractures are the most common fracture pattern in both groups. There is no age difference between groups. And finally, answer 5, mid-diaphyseal fractures are the most common fracture pattern in both groups, and the child sustaining non-accidental injury is likely to be older. The correct answer to this question is 2, mid-diaphyseal fractures are the most common fracture pattern in both groups, and the child sustaining non-accidental injury is likely to be younger. Mid-shaft fractures are the most common pattern in both non-accidental injuries and accidental injuries. The non-accidental injury group tends to be younger. To quickly review, femur fractures in children less than 3 years old is strongly suggestive of non-accidental injury. Non-accidental injury comprises up to 35% of femur fractures less than 3 years old and between 40 to 90% of cases less than 1 year old. A skeletal survey involving a chest X-ray, skull radiographs, and extremity radiographs is necessary in children less than 2 years old if abuse is suspected. Lateral thoracolumbar X-ray is indicated for children less than 12 months. Head CT scan should be performed on victims less than 1 year old or if neurological symptoms are present. If shaking is suspected, an ophthalmologic exam is also indicated. Hui et al. Retrospectively reviewed femur fractures in children less than 3 years old. The percentage of non-accidental injury was 11%. Risks for non-accidental injury include age less than 12 months, non-ambulatory, delayed presentation, unwitnessed/inconsistent mechanism of injury, and other associated injuries. They recommend a high index of suspicion for patients less than 3 years old with femur fractures. Baldwin et al. Retrospectively compared 70 non-accidental injuries and 139 accidental injuries for pediatric femur fractures. They found that history suspicious for abuse, physical or radiographic evidence of prior injury, and age less than 18 months were risk factors for abuse. Patients with no risk factors, one risk factor, two risk factors, and three risk factors had 4%, 29%, 87%, and a 92% chance of non-accidental injury, respectively. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, know that mid-diaphyseal fractures are the most common pattern in both non-accidental injury and accidental injury. While metaphyseal corner/bucket handle fractures are specific for non-accidental injury, they are not common. Children involved in non-accidental injury femur fractures tend to be younger and may even be preambulatory. Moving on to the next question. A 10-month-old child is brought to the emergency room with left elbow swelling and an intact neurovascular exam. The parents report no history of trauma. A radiograph demonstrates a minimally displaced distal humerus physeal separation with abundant callus formation. The next step in management should include, and the choices are 1, close reduction and percutaneous pinning, 2, casting only, 3, a skeletal survey and contacting the appropriate authorities, 4, elbow arthrogram, and 5, open reduction and internal fixation. The correct answer to this question is 3, a skeletal survey and contacting the appropriate authorities. So distal humeral physeal separations in the infant or young child are most often the result of violent traction or rotation and are commonly associated with child abuse. They may initially be difficult to recognize in newborns and young infants when the secondary ossification center is not apparent. In these cases, arthrography, ultrasound, or magnetic resonance imaging may be required to make the diagnosis. For young children presenting more than 3 weeks out, abundant callus formation may be noted. In children where there is ossification of the epiphyseal ossific nucleus, the diagnosis is typically made on plain radiographs. Once the diagnosis is confirmed, the next step should be further workup to assess for other injuries and to contact the appropriate authorities. The American Academy of Pediatrics section on radiology has recommended a mandatory skeletal survey in all cases of suspected abuse in children younger than 2 years of age. This may be followed by close reduction and casting, pinning, or rarely open reduction, but this is not the first step prior to assessing for other injuries and abuse in a neurovascularly intact child. The paper by Akbarnia et al. Details arthrography performed in 6 infants with an elbow injury confirming 4 Salter-Harris type 1 injuries and 2 Salter-Harris type 2 fractures. Abuse was confirmed in 2 patients and suspected in 2. And moving on to the final question, what are the 2 most common lesions seen in abused children? And the choices are 1, skin lesions and head injuries, 2, skin lesions and fractures, 3, visceral injuries and fractures, 4, visceral injuries and head injuries, and 5, skin lesions and visceral injuries. The correct answer to this question is 2, skin lesions and fractures. So the annual incidence of abuse is estimated at 15 to 42 cases per 1,000 children and is increasing. Skin lesions are the most common presentation, followed by fractures. Approximately 1/3 of abused children will eventually be seen by an orthopedic surgeon. Thus, it is essential that orthopedic surgeons have an understanding of physical abuse in the hopes of increasing the likelihood of recognition and appropriate management. There is no pathognomonic fracture pattern in abuse. Several factors, including the age of the child, the ambulation status, the overall injury pattern, the stated mechanism of injury, and pertinent psychosocial factors, must all be considered in each case. Musculoskeletal injury patterns suggestive of non-accidental injury include certain metaphyseal lesions in young children, fractures in various stages of healing, posterior rib fractures, and long bone fractures in children less than 2 years old. The differential diagnosis of abuse includes true accidental injury, osteogenesis imperfecta, and metabolic bone disease. Management should be multidisciplinary, with the key being recognition. Abused children have a substantial risk of repeated abuse and death. The Pandya et al. Article found that age is a key factor to consider in the evaluation. They stated that kids less than 18 months old with rib, tibia/fibula, humerus, or femur fractures are more likely to be victims of abuse than accidental trauma patients. Conversely, kids greater than 18 months old with long bone fractures, for example femur and humerus fractures, are more likely to be related to accidental trauma than child abuse. That's all for this review about pediatric abuse. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.